Hi, I'm Spencer Krause. I've been building robots for over 20 years. In that time, I've seen a lot of interesting things, and I've heard a lot of interesting stories. Collaborative with Spencer Krause is a place where my colleagues and I can relax, have a drink, and talk about some of the crazier things we've seen at work and some of the experiences we've had that have gotten us to where we are today. Subscribe today to join the collaboration. Welcome to the Collaborative Podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Krause. Our guest today is Chris Matthews. Chris is a marketing consultant, advisor, and leader with a lot of tech experience and some experience in robotics as well. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. So there's so many things I want to ask you about. You just have such an interesting career we were talking about. I mean, you worked for Specialized Bicycles for like 10 years. You worked for Ironox. You've been at some other robotics companies, Pebble before the acquisition. And you know, just awesome stuff. I guess one thing that comes to mind right off the bat is like, what made you decide to switch from like bicycles over to like deep tech? I mean, that seems pretty different, but I guess there's a lot of overlap in those cultures.
Well, Specialized and a lot of the bicycle industry has a lot of actual overlap with the way startups work, and particularly the way technical startups work, because you're constantly reinventing stuff every year, right? Especially at the high end, new products, new innovations, like it is a industry that is constantly pushing edges. And that can be on like material science and carbon fiber. It can be on suspension science. It can be on tires. It can be on aerodynamics, like so many different facets to it. And you know, one thing's for sure, you never really leave cycling. like the garage is full, right? And I ride all the time.
Nice.
And I still deeply value a lot of the connections I have in that industry. Once in a while, I get to dip my toe back in for, you know, projects here and there. But it was an opportunity back in 2013 where a guy I knew who I raced bikes with actually was getting a startup off the ground. And after a few conversations with him, giving him a little bit of early guidance, he asked if I would be part of the founding team. And I looked at that and was like, yeah, that seems really interesting. And so as is the case with a lot of startups, you learn a lot real fast, but I ended up getting a little bit addicted to the, just to the pace of how fast startups move and how much new stuff was constantly happening. And it's like, as long as I can still ride my bike once in a while, this is still super fun. And that led to the beginning of what's now been a little over 10 years of working with different technical startups.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that's what keeps me in that sector too, is just the different challenges and all the interesting people you get to interact with. So
yep.
Yeah, totally. For sure. It's addictive is a good word for it.
What other industry has as much sort of new things every time you, not just day to day, but like across the day, right? Like we just went through that whole OpenAI debacle, and like what a year that week was, right?
that's pretty good. What ended up happening there? I didn't even follow like where Sam Altman ended up landing.
So he's back at the helm.
Hilarious. That's amazing.
New board, and Microsoft now has a board seat. I am not the best person to interview about this.
No worries. We can talk about something else.
But wow. Like yeah. That was like, even the podcast that we're covering it couldn't cover it fast enough. Cause by the time the podcast was out,
it was a totally different situation.
It was a totally different situation again, right? Like you listen to like Paris Swisher and Scott Galloway try and follow it. And it's like, they would have had to release several episodes a day.
Yeah. Makes sense to me. This is how I get my news, by the way, is just asking people what's going on.
Nice.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah. So one of the other things I love about your career trajectory is I have a pretty close friend. His name's Uriel Eisen. I met him in the Carnegie Mellon Robotics Club, and he now has a company making bike packing buckles. So I feel like he followed like a reverse trajectory.
Sometimes it's the technical folks getting into the sport, and it does happen. Yeah. But Yeah, there's lots of space inside cycling for lots of new ideas all the time.
Oh yeah. Well, and this guy's definitely clever. Like I remember I got some Russian aircraft titanium years ago for a battle bot I was building, and I sold him some for like some small markup on what I'd paid for it, and he was trying to make lightweight bikepacking gear. And so he was addicted to like, can I get my tent down to like 9 ounces, or how light can I make the bracket that holds the thing? So,
I know folks like that.
yeah, that's awesome. So, I guess how'd you get into marketing? What kind of keeps you in that discipline? What are some of the things that you work on and kind of your philosophies around that?
Well, first of all, I'll say thank you for calling it a discipline, because that is something I believe pretty strongly. Like, marketing
I
is
agree.
a discipline, not an activity. I actually got into it just by doing it. And not because I knew I was doing it, but because it was what seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And I go back all the way to, like, when I was going through putting myself through university, working in a bike shop, and realizing that working in a bike shop was partly about getting people in the door. And so you're doing things like running group rides and hosting events and going out to, community things where you're getting the word out about what you're doing to try and get people to show up. And that then over time just got polished and polished and polished, and then ended up going back to grad school, got an MBA, and then got this opportunity to specialize right after that. And that's where, over the course of the next 10 years, I saw how to do it at big scale.
That's awesome. So it sounds like you developed a knack for it naturally, but then you got the credentials with the MBA that got you that job, and then you were able to build the pedigree from there. That's cool.
I mean, the foundation of it is I've always been a storyteller, and good marketing is at its core about storytelling and bringing people along for a ride. So that served me as well or better than anything. And that's everything from reading lots of books as a kid to, like, creative writing on my own. But that really set a good foundation. It's like that Karate Kid stuff, right? Like, you don't really learn know what you're learning when you're doing it, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, I can do things.
That's kind of how I got into robotics engineering, right? So I always liked tinkering, and I mean the master's degree I got at Carnegie Mellon, I feel like just legitimized all the stuff that I'd been doing up until then my whole life. But now people know I'm good at it because I had a piece of paper. So, yeah, I can relate. That's awesome. So with this latest book you wrote, Start Telling People, what is some of the reasons that you decided to kind of sit down and get some of your thoughts out on paper?
So that it came out in May, so it's been, like, what, a little over 6 months now. And it was really just it was a chance to sit down and think, what patterns have I seen across all these different industries I've worked in, from bicycles, but also from health tech and med tech to robotics and AI, wearables, climate tech. It's a big range, but there were some common themes that kept showing up. And so it started out as a quest of, like, hey, I'm going to write a few blog posts, right? Like, I got some ideas in my head. I want to get them out on paper. And all of a sudden I had, like, a dozen blog posts as titles. And it's like, wait a second, these are like chapters almost. And kind of shuffle them around, and then, like, yeah, I think this holds together. And so in the space of one day, I put together the chapter titles and summaries, shopped it around to a few smart people I knew, and I was like, does this make sense to you too? And got a bunch of head nods yes. I was like, okay, here we go.
That's awesome.
And it really focuses on marketing for those early stage companies, particularly tech companies. So folks a lot like what the folks you work with, where they've maybe been working on something for a while, and now it's to the point where, okay, this is now a commercially viable idea. well, I need to stop being a secret. This actually has to come out into the open air. How do you make that transition? How do you get started? And a lot of the rules and a lot of the things to think about and places to get tripped up when you're at that stage are pretty different than a standard marketing 101 textbook. So what I tried to do was put together all those differences, right? I'm not parroting out a bunch of basics or putting out things that, you know, are just kind of standard rote. It's really, what should you think about differently for those first couple years? And how do you migrate through those quickly without stumbling too much?
That's awesome.
And that's the book. So it's been great. It's been a lot of fun to sort of have the book out in the world, and you know, you get people you don't know writing reviews of it, and you get people inviting you to talk about it. And it's like, all right, this is an interesting side quest here that was just very available. I don't know if you've sort of followed the process of writing a book, but
not at all.
But
I'm interested.
The ability to self-publish now has basically, you know, has opened up the option to writing a book to a lot of people that previously wouldn't have been able to. And even a book like this, even done well, the audience is tiny, right? Like I understand it's a niche topic. And there's probably not many or any publishers out there, traditional publishers, that would have looked at a first-time author writing about a super niche topic and said, oh yeah, we're going to get on that one. So even though it has still sold well, it's never going to be like a New York Times bestseller. It's not for everybody, but for the people for whom it's for, it's pretty unique.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds amazing. I mean, I certainly can't wait to read it myself. So,
well, it's there when you're ready, but I mean, if you want to take the time to write your own book first, that's okay too.
I probably am going to read yours before I write mine.
Okay.
Yeah, which may never happen, but I hope it does.
Well, I mean, your podcast is an outlet in the same kind of way, right? Like this is a thing where you used to have access to a radio network. And instead, you know, Spencer Krause has a podcast that anyone can tune into. And it has an audience that is very tuned to the messaging you want to put out.
Oh, it's super niche for sure. I mean, yeah. It's just nerds that have robotics companies or work in robotics companies,
fantastic.
Or tech fanatics. Yeah. And a few people have come up to me at trade events or, you know, reached out to me on LinkedIn or, you know, recognized me when I visit, you know, my school I went to at Carnegie Mellon, and they said, I love your podcast. You know, it's the best. Yeah. You interview amazing people. You know, how do you get these people to come on? I'm just like, I don't know, just ask.
Yep.
But, you know, it always makes you happy. So I'm glad that, you know, you've been experiencing that as well. And
you know, absolutely.
Yeah, it's quite a thing. Quite a roller coaster ride for sure.
Yep.
Yeah. So I guess marketing, I feel like, is one of those things where, you know, a lot of startup founders are probably a little bit like me, where, you know, they're engineers first and then, you know, they start to think about business, and it's not always apparent. Like I think to a lot of people, there's this perception that maybe it's fluffy, but I mean, obviously that's horse shit. Like you can't sell a product without telling people about it. And so, you know, to quote, you know, kind of one of the guys whose book I read a while ago, Zig Ziglar, like, you know, you can make the best mousetrap in the world, but nobody's going to pave a path to your door without a sales effort. And marketing's a little bit different than sales, but it's also somewhat similar. Well, I mean,
they're certainly related, right? You got that weird Venn diagram overlap of marketing, sales, product, and customer service.
Yeah.
And
it's all communication at different points in the, I guess, funnel, yeah, to be cliche,
and you, like, you rely on all of them in an even more interconnected than it ever used to be, right? It used to be more linear, and now it's kind of like the internet made it all messy, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. It's not really a funnel because that implies it's a line.
Yeah,
it's like they're all working all at the same time. Maybe customer service, like after sales and marketing before sales, but products connected to all of them all the time. I don't know.
Well, customer service that goes through all of it. And I think customer service has become a brand asset more so than it ever used to be.
How do you figure? Can you give me examples?
Well, like you go back not that many years, right? Like 10, 20, it's a lot, but it's not that much.
Yeah, I agree.
And you had like an 800 number, right? And now some rando sees something you did on TikTok, flips over to Twitter and writes about it. And then that tweet then gets picked up by somebody else who replies to it with a question to you, the company. And all of a sudden you're in this public conversation that someone at your company has the opportunity to chime in and participate in that could be the starting of a customer relationship. And this is B2C and B2B, right? It doesn't play favorites. And then now your social media channels become what your 800 number used to be, except everyone gets to listen in all the time.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right?
It's really interesting.
And if you do that really well, that gets rewarded because other people see it, right? And that becomes part of something you're known for, right? But a brand is a promise.
Oh, that's really interesting. So that is both customer service, marketing, and sales all simultaneously.
Totally. Yeah.
And it probably feeds into your product team as well, because all that feedback gets taken into consideration.
Right. Exactly. And there's fantastic tools out there to synthesize a lot of it, you know, autonomously. So you can start seeing trends and sentiment changes without having to do bit by bit analysis. Like, you can actually put metrics behind this stuff.
What are some of the tools you like for doing that and kind of aggregating that chaotic mass of data? It could be chaotic, but sounds like it doesn't have to be.
Like things like Sprout Social is one. Or even like even what you can do inside HubSpot or any of the marketing automation tools. What was the other one? There's another one I saw recently that was really interesting. Blanking on the name of it right now, but like, I think part of it is it's not about the specific tool so much as just the tools change all the time, right? There's new ones introduced, and part of the attitude that is really helpful in these situations is like, what's the problem we want to go solve right now? And then go out and look for what new tools or what new capabilities are out there that maybe weren't even there 6 months ago.
Makes sense.
Like marketing in particular, there's a deluge of new tools and new opportunities to do things all the time. And you get pitched every way all the time with like, hey, you should try our new thing, try our new thing, try our new thing. So if you're not taking stock of like the tools you're using every 6 months or so, you might be missing something that's better for you, that's cheaper, that's easier to integrate with other stuff. Like whatever your tech stack is on marketing and analytics is something that can change really quickly, and you want to be on the lookout for new stuff. And that's more of an attitude, right? It's yes, you might find a tool that you really like and it goes into your workflow really well, and that's great. But the moment something better comes along, you got to be willing to figure out how to take advantage of it, because your competitors will.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Right? This is also kind of part of the advantages of being a startup too, is you're making all these decisions from white cloth. So you get to go out and look at what are the best options and understand which one's best for you, and not be tied down to a bunch of legacy decisions that you made like 10 or 20 years ago that are, you know, met with a whole bunch of resistance to change.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really healthy outlook, right? I think it's easy to get stuck. I mean, you know, marketing or not, just, you know, like, I've always been a Microsoft guy. I'll be a Microsoft guy till the day I die. Or, we only use Google Drive. You know, we're never going to go away from that. And, you know.
And like, sometimes that sometimes that does work for certain things, because sometimes that's not the biggest problem you got to solve right now.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure you've got a collection of tools that you go to on the regular. I do as well. And I expect that list for me will be different a year from now than it is today.
Same here.
What's your favorite like cool internet tool right now?
Internet tool. So when you say internet tool, you mean like just a thing I use on the internet?
Yeah, like an app or a website.
Can LinkedIn count? Like, I think that's probably...
No. I'm talking about like, what do you use to edit your podcast? Or like, what do you use
Oh, that's interesting.
What are you using for a personal CRM or anything like that?
So this is kind of embarrassing. My personal CRM is a combination of Google Calendar and just random Google Docs that are dated with a person's name and a date that I talk to them. And if I search a name, it'll come up with... Yeah. Every meeting log from when I've talked to that person. Also LinkedIn.
Awesome.
I mean, just
yeah.
If I go back, if I forget who someone was and I have a meeting with them, which does happen because, you know what, I mean, I'm sure you're like this too. You talk to, you know, like 20 people a day or something, and it just, you know, start to mm-hmm. blur together after a while.
Sometimes, did you remember who I was?
Yeah, of course. But sometimes I'll go back to a LinkedIn thread. And I'll say, you know, like, what did I talk to, you know, Steve Bohemi about, you know, and I'll mm-hmm. like, you know, read through and I'll be, oh, right. That's why I was excited to talk to this guy.
Yep.
You know, and so I don't know. My brain tends to shut down and get kind of lazy and having that. What do you use as a personal CRM?
It's actually mostly Notepad. So nice. It's kind of similar, but like in the same way that Mac migrates those across and syncs them across iCloud.
Yeah, that's the best.
But it's about, in that case, it's like consistency. You know, and you have to use it all the time in the same way for everybody, because it's no good if like some people are there and some people aren't.
Yep, I completely agree. Yeah,
like, and that and a good password manager.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a simple. One password's pretty awesome in my opinion. Yep. Like it's yep. been super helpful. Plus, yep. it's just interesting to see how many accounts you amalgamate, right? I think I'm up to like 300.
Yeah, right? and all of the stuff that's in there that you don't use anymore. And
yeah, for sure. When I always like roll my eyes, like another portal, you know. And then, but I feel like with a good password manager, you know, like you're like another portal. I can deal with this, you know. So yeah, not so bad anymore. That was a game changer. What are some of the other tools you like?
Let's see. Descript is one that impresses me a lot. I'm not sure if you've seen that one.
That's the one that will take a podcast and like transcribe all the... I've heard about it. Yeah. I've considered integrating it. I haven't yet for this podcast. I'm not against it. Just haven't gotten around to it.
For audio and video editing, it's really impressive.
You can type, right? And then it's meant to actually do splices in real time.
Totally. So yeah. you can take an audio file, and you know, this is one of the applications of AI that, you know, is could be used for good, could be used for not good. But, you can take an audio file like this one, upload it, and then it will give you a kickback a transcript, and like that's fine. You know, lots of places do that, but then you can go edit that transcript like a Word doc.
That's
and
cool.
It updates the audio file.
That's really cool.
Up to and including adding words that weren't said. So like, yeah, like there's good uses for that.
You could also make somebody say horrible things that would end
could.
Their career.
And you know, this is also why, you know, trust but verify, like validation on anything you see on the internet. Yeah, you got to think about that.
Yeah, that's wild.
And they're not. That's not a problem unique to them. That's a problem.
You know, well, I mean, it's just where we're at in terms of
yeah.
society and the technology.
Yeah, right. But I think the bigger piece here is that there are more creative tools available to more people now that make editing and production easier than it's ever been. And this certainly ties to marketing, right? Like what used to take an agency or like a gigantic production team. Now, like, I've had people working for me that create incredible content at scale, like big volumes, and it's just them and like using a handful of tools.
That's awesome.
And you know, yes, it takes skill. Like it still requires skill, but it is definitely more available than it's ever been. So now you see people who you know, used to be like, oh, you want to make a video? Like, here's an editing bay and an Avid suite. And like, and now it's like, no, I can just make videos on my phone
Yep.
and they look great. So some of these tools coming out are, and particularly when you get to generative AI, like this is, it's really changing the
It's
landscape.
pretty wild. I mean, like I've not used it at work as much as I could, but just seeing what's feasible and what's possible and like some of the things that are coming out of it, it's incredible technology. I mean, obviously, you know, gonna go down in history, I think, is one of the, you know, bigger deal technological achievements of humanity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the adoption curve on it is super fast, right? It was like about a year ago today that GPT-3 came out, right?
Yep.
And you look at,
And you try it and you're like, holy crap.
sure. But then all the other offshoots of like what can be done with that and how far it's come even in a year, right? Like, and it's wild, for sure. But we're still very early on in these AI days where like the tech is starting to form, but the applications of it are still these like little point solutions on top of the surface, right? You're very few companies have completely rebuilt themselves around AI. They're
Yeah, for
using
sure.
AI, they're using AI on the surface to solve specific problems. But there's a book I read recently that was made a really interesting point or an analog between that and electricity. When electricity came out, like it was invented in 1879, and it took 50 years to get electricity in half the households in the US. So you think about the scale of like how long it took to roll out because of how difficult it was to, you know, basically rewire houses.
Yeah, well, I mean, probably the public utility too. I mean, you had to run cable, that's expensive. Someone's got to maintain it. New technology had to be developed to scale it. I mean, you know, you have to figure out how to do it, you know, industrial scale.
And industrial was like part of that, the key of that, that factories used to be powered by steam turbines.
Yep.
And that steam turbine ran through the whole factory and you kind of offshoot the power out from it. And then you've got electricity. Well, like we can put electricity anywhere in specific spots. That means you have to basically level the factory and rebuild it. But it also means that the people who do that fastest get the benefit from it quickest and can scale up potentially faster. So it'll be interesting, with a capital I, interesting to watch AI sort of go through that level of genesis and where you see companies that previously couldn't have existed at all. And exist on a foundation of AI. I don't know what they're going to be exactly, or what the big winners will be, but
I don't think anybody really knows yet. I mean, maybe some people think they know. Like, I'm sure some of them are guessing correctly, some of them aren't.
So here we are, and it's an intersection of all the other things that you know folks like you work on too, and the folks that we know, right? Robots, computer vision, machine learning, deep learning, like
Yeah.
it's all starting to roll together into this
You know, it's.
interconnected web.
There was a project that I worked on recently where it was some perception engineering work, and I was just in a project management role on this. But basically, we were looking at ways to figure out what things were in an environment that a robot was operating in and where they were relative to the robot. And sometimes AI was the right solution, and sometimes it wasn't. And so we were. I kind of like that, like, you know, using it as like just another tool, you know, like, yeah, sometimes it's perfect. Like some of the things we were able to do with processing like dirty like sensor streams by applying AI-based filtering to them. Like it was incredible. Like you could clean up really messy data in a way that, you know, was inference-based, but, you know, surprisingly good, you know, like pretty damn impressive. Then other times we were using classical techniques, you know, and that was really, really effective. And so, you know, I think, I don't know if it's a one size fits all. I mean, maybe as the tech gets better, you know, like AI will start to supplant more and more classical, you know, control methodologies and technologies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think at least where we're at right now, it doesn't necessarily equate to the solution for everything. It's incredible and it's amazing. And I'm in complete awe over what's happened, as you put it, in the last year. But I don't know that it's the solution to every problem I face at work. So I don't know.
No, probably not. But it also is likely a solution to questions we haven't even asked yet.
Probably, yes.
And so like that's where things get really, like, I get really curious about that. It kind of reminds me of like people working on this cutting edge in any of the spectrums, right? Like there's that obligation to explain what it is you're doing. And this is some of the hardest work that I end up doing, is essentially this translation layer between a really talented engineering team and the rest of the world, right? Like how do we take the thing you're working on, the intent of what you're doing, and understanding that it takes an incredible collection of intellectual horsepower to bring this to market, usually a big team of people. But then you got to put it in terms that people can understand how it fits into their world, right? Like you have to be able to explain purpose and place. And so if you're making something, like what does it do for them, right? Not how it works, but what does it do for them? Those are different questions. And then how does it fit into the life that they're living now, right? Where does it go? What does it replace? What does it make better? There's those two questions. If you answer both of them, that can get someone to change their behavior. But if you just answer one of them, it's not enough.
So how and why are the two questions?
Well, it's what does it do, right? Like what's the purpose of this thing you've made? What does it do for me? What is the outcome of having that as a benefit? And then help me understand where it fits. So the classical one to pick on would be like the Segway, right?
Yeah.
Which, like,
pretty good example.
phenomenal example of like, it's a great, like, magical tech, right? Like the thing looks like it shouldn't work and it does. But there wasn't a place for that to live.
Yeah, especially at the price point they introduced it at. I mean,
like even at any price point, like where do you ride?
Yeah, I guess you're right. For like $300, I mean, you can get a hoverboard. You still don't buy it.
So it was like, you have to figure out not only what it does for them, but where it fits in. This is like what the classical marketing world would call positioning. Right, where's your space in the world that you want to occupy, and how are you going to communicate that that's your spot? And tech companies, particularly innovative tech companies, really have to work hard at that, establishing that, because otherwise people don't understand you. And that can mean that you have a great thing, but people can't wrap their head around what it's for, or where it fits, so they don't buy it, because it's anxiety building.
Or it's unnecessary.
Or perceived as unnecessary. Like maybe it's great for them, but you know, you and I have both purchased products over the years that once you got it, you're like, ah, this thing is way better than I thought.
Air fryer. I didn't want to like it, and then I got one, and I'm like, this thing's amazing.
and if they could have communicated what that was going to be like to you in advance, you would have probably got it sooner.
Yeah, quite possibly.
So
if it had landed, sure. Yeah, I'm a cynical bastard, but
Like the translation layer between engineering and rest of world like crops up in really interesting ways. Like the just talking to someone a couple days ago, working on a computer vision project, and it was in the context of autonomous vehicles, and they were talking about how they solve blind spots. And what became apparent after I like probed a little bit was they didn't mean physical optical blind spots for the car. They meant blind spots in the computer vision model.
Interesting. I wouldn't have figured that out.
Well, but it's the same term, right? But in the computer vision model world, that means a very different thing than a blind spot in a car that you have to like look over your shoulder to cover.
Yeah.
But when computer vision starts working inside the autonomous vehicle world, well, gosh, that's gotten really close together. And now you've got to challenge you to communicate. And so you got to think through those things of like, we're kind of colliding with part of the world that we want to land in. We better be very, very clear about what we're trying to say.
Yeah, that makes sense. So maybe instead of blind spot, say shortcoming.
Or like something, yeah. Like there are plenty of ways through this, but if you don't realize it's an issue, you can be having the same conversation with someone and they think you mean something very, very different.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Do you find examples help in communicating new concepts that I guess maybe the public's not familiar with yet? So,
oh, absolutely. Like one of my favorite questions is compared to what?
Compared to like an abstract notion.
No, but like,
oh,
that,
I see.
that is the question, right? Like if you force someone to say compared to what and put things in relatable terms, you start building these like connection points of like, okay, I see how that it's this for that, or it's similar to, or I can use that as a foundation for understanding this other thing. And you're kind of building rungs in the ladder that they can climb up with you. Because like, maybe you've worked on something for 3 years, right? It's to you, it's second nature. And then you kind of like give someone the 30-second spiel that represents your most recent 30 seconds with it. And they're like, wait, can you, what? compared to what is a helpful framing question. The other is, I mean, just helping someone explain. Actually, I'm going to take this one step back. You have to understand who you want to sell to, right? Like customer segmentation becomes critical for early stage startups. And it's one of the things that I work with companies on frequently is like, how do we decide, maybe not who this is for entirely, but who do we want it to be for first, right? Who are the first customers that would be ideal? Because your first 100 customers often end up defining who your first 10,000 customers are.
Oh, that's interesting. So you wouldn't even necessarily worry about, you know, trying to figure out what product maturity looks like when you're concepting a new thing, so much as how do we just get this adopted, and then what's going to happen is going to happen, and you might not even be able to figure that out, you know, when you're at the whiteboard.
Well, it's you're making it for someone, and there's some kind of profile to that group of people, some commonality that they hold together that means like, because you can't make something for everyone, right? Like if you're trying to say our thing is for everyone, it's for nobody.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. Juicero had pretty good mass appeal, I thought.
Uh-huh. So did Segway.
Yeah, so did the Segway.
The road of failures is littered with things that were for everyone.
Yeah. But like some of those are just spectacular failures. I mean, I guess with Segway, it's amazing because of the amount of money they raised. I guess with Juicero, it's similar. It's the fact that there was an echo chamber of people that were convinced that everybody would want this thing that
yep.
when exposed to a mass audience just doesn't make sense.
Momentum is very powerful, right? And remember that in any population, half are below average.
Yeah.
It's just true.
By definition, right? Of average. So, yeah. Like,
but it means that sometimes you can build momentum in the wrong place. And so you go back to, like, who would you love to have as your first 100 customers as an exercise? And you can be very, very specific about that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? And it can be partly because you're choosing those people based on who they will bring with them, like what momentum they create. And is that the right momentum for where you want to go with this?
So to rescind what I said earlier, that would require you to think about where you want it to be.
Totally.
Down the road.
Yep.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yep. And so long-term thinking is part of it, but you have to break it up into manageable chunks. Like, especially if you're an early stage startup with like limited resources, yeah, and you know, maybe a smaller team.
And it also seems like you probably have to be willing to roll with the punches if, you know, maybe the market responds differently than you thought it would.
Well, then you get into research, right? Like, okay, so that first 100, what's it based on? Why do you think that? How well have you tested those edges? To what degree can you test it in advance? You know, the ability to do things like national surveys now, incredibly easy, incredibly cheap. You can get data back tomorrow on a statistically valid sample size for a very specific target demographic. And there's lots of services that you can jump in for that. One of the things with, there's a whole chapter in the book on this, all about data, right? Like early stage startups, you might not have a lot of data, but you have some. And it's false to say you can't go get some, right? So like, just because you don't have data doesn't mean you should just throw up your hands and start guessing at stuff. Like, no, you need to have an attitude towards going to find it. Like, literally grab a shovel, start digging. And there's lots of ways to do that, and lots of models out there to follow, and lots of potential ways of even just getting like a little bit of data. Cause like the data chapter actually includes a sort of podcast type interview I did with a colleague of mine who's ex exec at ad agencies, but like particularly adept at the whole marketing data side of the world.
Oh, interesting.
And so I think when you get to that chapter, you'll enjoy it. Chapter 9. And one of the things he said that stuck with me was that data it's all about making decisions, right? And a little bit of data gives you a little bit more confidence in the decision you're about to make. And so you might not get 100% confident, but you can certainly get further towards that. And if you're just going to deal with 0% confidence, now you're just talking about opinions. And so like the opinions can be, you know, you're probably going to take the one of the highest paid person in the room. But if you can get to data is a way to defeat opinions. And then the sort of pinnacle above data is being able to understand the world in a way that you get to some sort of insight. Some sort of thing that says, well, the data says this, so I think this is going to happen next. And I believe that's true. Yeah, I can't prove that in advance because it's a new idea. You can't prove a new idea in advance. But I can take this chunk of data and say, extrapolating from that, I feel X amount confident that we're going to go here. And it's all just a data process, but it's how confident can you be in that, and what can you go find out?
That's interesting. So it's like a hybridized decision making where, I mean, you yep. can't do it totally data driven because it's never been done before, but
exactly.
you can make your guesses more informed.
Yep. Like in some cases, companies are doing things where like they've made the best version of something, right? Like I've figured out how to,
yeah, well, that would have to be data-driven, I would think.
Of course. And so that's going to be vastly more biased towards the data-driven side because you probably have a lot of access to really good data. But if you're making something that is wholly entirely new, right, there's no existing demand for it. No one understands what it is. You got some work to do.
Yeah. And you're going to learn a lot, I think, when you put the first one out or when you get into the hands of, you know, a pilot team or a group of users or whatever.
Right. And part of that is being very methodical about going to get that data in a way where if you're going to try and map the data over time, that your data is consistent enough that you can see changes.
Yeah.
Because like you do a bunch of user testing and then 6 months later do another group of user testing and you ask all different questions with all different hardware. It's very hard to compare those two.
Yeah, they don't map at all, I would think. Right. I mean,
yeah.
It's like, to use an example from robotics, it would be like if you changed from a LiDAR to a stereo camera and you tried to correlate.
Well, you could probably get relevant data of like, did we get more or less accurate?
Yeah, and I mean, you could still map to like an occupancy grid and try to, you know,
yep,
put that in a neutral form so it could go into a model.
Right. But if you then, you know, say you're trying to map that onto like 3D Gaussian splats or something like that, it, then all of a sudden it's like, wait, hold up.
Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely. So how do you feel about stealth startups? I guess just to go into maybe something a little bit controversial, but.
Sure.
To, you know, because that's like the ultimate, you know, like we're just going to do this in a vacuum and, you know. I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts. I guess I shouldn't poison it with mine.
Certain companies make that choice for usually around reasons around IP. Like we're trying to develop something that is defensible as long as we can get the patents around it or whatever that that protection is going to be. A lot of other companies, though, they're pretty open about what they're doing. And that's because they're trying to attract good talent. They're trying to validate a market. They're trying to like look for product market fit. They're looking for feedback anywhere they can get it. And
I tend to favor that approach. I tend to favor that approach.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people that follow that same approach. And I think it's become more common because people have realized that people are mostly too busy to steal your idea. Like everyone's got their own thing going on. They don't understand the idea the way you do. So unless you've got something really obvious, it's not theftable. And if it's really obvious, it's probably already been done.
Or someone, exactly. Or someone will figure it out because maybe the tech just came out a week ago that you're trying to act on, but you've got seven competitors you don't know about at least, you know?
Right. Like there are times when, you might have to keep things pretty zipped up, quiet. There's usually lawyers involved in those decisions. You know, sometimes it's government contract stuff, like who knows, right?
Yeah, for sure. But
for the most part, the secrets, like the fully stealth startup mentality isn't always necessary.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree.
Sometimes it's just done by default. Like people just aren't talking about it because they're not quite confident enough in it yet. And they don't want to talk about it until they get a little bit more confident that they're onto something.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense. So it's an ego thing. Like you're worried about getting embarrassed if you let this idea out into the world.
Well, or just like you want it to be successful. It's almost like not the anxiety of the failure, but you want to be putting your personal capital on something that is exciting and feels like really viable. And so you want to like put your best foot forward, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty common desire. It's just whether or not you can pull it off.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I remember maybe it was a year ago, there were two different companies that my team was looking at working with. and they were direct competitors, and one of them was in stealth and one of them was not. And I think it was actually an offshoot from the same group, and they just went two different directions with it. And I won't say what they were doing because I don't want to, you know, betray anyone's secrecy, but I'll say that the one that wasn't in stealth appeared to be greatly outperforming the one that was in stealth, from, you know, visiting both of their facilities and talking to them closely and seeing the technology and the directions they went. The one that wasn't in stealth, I mean, I met the founder of that company at a trade event where he showed me a video of the technology, like within a minute of meeting him. The one that was in stealth, I met them through a referral through another contract engineering company that was going to kick it over. And then it was like a series of phone calls and then NDAs. And then you talk to this person, they'll introduce you to that person. And then you start making calls, you know, and like getting references on these people and digging into it. You're like, wow, they really don't seem to have as much as the guys that are just openly talking about it. And I think part of that has to have been, you know, that the ones that were talking about it openly, because they were, you know, getting it out in the world and socializing it, were probably getting better feedback earlier on that they could incorporate into their design and attract better talent. And also, you know, like, you know, just base their decisions off of reality rather than hypothesis.
Yeah, you get better signal, better access to talent, and those things early on, like, you think about a team of three that adds one person to that team, like the percentage you can leap forward on that, if that's a good hire, is massive. And you want the right people on the boat early. So putting the word out about what you're doing, it often will get to the right people.
Yeah.
And so,
not to mention, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, okay, good.
I was going to say your company's culture is instrumental in success, and that's a function of the average of the people that are there.
Totally. But one of the things I tell startups that I work with is like there's an alarm bell that goes off at some point where you're going to hear someone in a startup say, when do we add marketing or how do we add marketing? Like, and it's that's the indicator, like, it's about time to start thinking about this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
But they're not evenly weighted questions. It's because it's like 98% how do we add marketing and about 2% when. And the reason for that is like marketing started when you started your company, right? As soon as you decided what you were going to make, who it was for, the story you tell when you're trying to hire someone, all of that storytelling is part of what's going to be the foundation for your marketing. And so you've already started. So it's really just a question of then like, okay, well, how are we going to do this? And then you start thinking about tactics and what's unique to your situation that you're going to need. Like there are some tactics that are pretty common across different categories, but there are some that are very unique. And so there isn't a template for how, but that is where the bulk of the work is.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. I mean, it's, I guess I'm fortunate to have, you know, a marketing advisor I really, really respect in Jess Pedersen, who I've talked to you about before. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, she really helped me realize that, you know, there's no option. Like, you can't not be doing it. I think I told you I have a relative that, you know, was a pretty high-powered executive in a large company. He retired recently. But he told me that at the scale of business that, you know, SKA is at, the biggest mistake that I could make with respect was to marketing was not to. That really left a huge mark. You know, well, I agree wholeheartedly with all of that.
And also, like, what does it mean to do marketing, right? Like, marketing is vastly more than placing ads.
Sure.
You know, back to where we started the conversation, like, marketing's a discipline in the same way that, like, skiing is a discipline. You can go skiing for the day and have a good time, but if you want to be a pro skier and, like, race World Cup GS, you have to understand how everything connects. It's your equipment. It's knowing conditions. It's knowing nutrition. It's knowing sleep patterns. It's knowing competitors. And you've refined stuff to the point where activities are a reflex that all interconnect. And you can't just change one thing. You have to like think about the impacts of it change on all the other things.
Makes sense to me.
When you can introduce marketing, particularly to like really technical folks, as a more interconnected discipline, lights kind of come on of like, ah, okay, like I see this now more like, you know, how someone might look at a circuit board or like a chipset. Like it's there is the thing itself, but there is all of the other things that it powers and connects with and relies upon. And that interconnectedness, once it gets started, you don't unravel that. Like that becomes, I think, to your point, part of your company's culture.
I think it has to be for your company to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Totally. So to go back to how to start marketing, though, I just want to revisit one thing there, that it is different for a lot of companies, but there are a couple of things that are similar. And one of the things that I've really latched onto with some of the folks I've worked with is around demos. And this is a really fascinating moment of intersection between like the product side of the house and the marketing side of the house, because giving a great demo is not a skill that is inherent in making the product. You have to learn how to get good at demos. And that is a learnable skill, but it's not innate. So I work with companies to basically rebuild their whole approach to demo.
Oh, that's interesting.
And make that, instead of a point of anxiety, right? Like I'm sure you've given product demos before, right? And you know how that feels, right? Like the moment before you start a demo and you're just like,
hope nothing breaks.
Exactly, right? And hope is not a strategy. It's not. So yeah.
No, practice, contingency.
Exactly. What have you done to prep for this so that you know it's going to go smoothly in terms of how the audience sees it, right? I've run product demos that have had like some serious problems, but the audience never knew that because they've never seen your thing before. They don't know. They know what the expectation that you set. So if you're prepped for slight left turns, deviations, flipping scripts, if you've got a really good backbench of engineering behind you that's like shelled into the robot on RViz and is like, you know, watching to make sure that, you know, things are going right, like you can reboot a robot in the middle of a demo and your audience doesn't have to know that happened.
That's awesome.
But the only way you can pull that off is if you've practiced and if you really have a very careful approach to how you've built that demo. Because we've all seen failed demos, right?
Yeah. I think the Sony Aibo climbing the stairs is a famous one.
A certain person put a metal ball through the window of a pickup truck once.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
Sorry, twice.
When I saw that, I originally thought that was intentional. Like, I'm like, oh, it's just having some fun. Like, I thought it was supposed to because I didn't know.
History on that one, I think, has a few versions that will get written down. And, you know, one of them's right and some of the others are not. And there are people who were very close to that situation that really know. And the rest of us know what the best we can figure out. But irrespective of that, demos fail a lot, and it's an evidence of an attitude that is just like, well, what do you mean? I just show the product to people, right? That's a demo. And that's a long way from the sort of precision and accuracy that you need if you want to run flawless demos all the time. And demos are one common thing that, like, no matter what your startup's doing, you got to be able to give a demo. And you got to know your audience. You got to know, is this like a hiring an employee demo? Is this an investor demo? Is it a media demo? Is it a sales demo? And
That
you
makes
got to
sense.
understand the environments that you can give those in, because like they can be in real life in person, they can be virtual. All of those factors matter. And so another whole chapter in the book on that, but it is one of the topics that, particularly in the robotics space, that I got really good at because it was a function of survival, right? Like you just had to. And you build all of these contingencies in because you know how it works.
And if you practice, you know where the common failure points are and how to quickly mitigate them.
And really, there are three, right? The demons of demo: Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and battery.
Hilarious.
That most demo problems are one of those three things.
Yeah. Wi-Fi definitely, I mean, there's ways around that. Like, I know
Of
there's
course.
a demo we gave during the pandemic where we let people drive robots through a obstacle course, and I'm looking at it now because all the cameras for the podcast studio are mounted on it. But basically, it was like a 5 kilo robot, and people could drive it through like a industrial maze that we had an out of work Broadway set designer develop, and used Formant to be able to drive it. So those guys set up their software on our robot, and it just gave people the controls and made it a competition. And the common failure was actually the robot flipping over because, well, there were a few of them. So one was a bolt would vibrate loose. This happened once and land on the NVIDIA board that was controlling the thing and cause a short circuit, which, yeah, luckily it didn't blow up. It just power cycled when that happened. So that wasn't too bad. You know, Loctite is how you fix that. Another one that occurred was Wi-Fi outages, to quote you. So we had a pretty awesome industrial grade Wi-Fi access point put into the office after that. And then another one was we originally, when we were practicing it, we wanted to use a spark gap generator to make the industrial maze look a little bit more sinister. So the idea was to have like a wire hanging and sparking against the floor with like a 15 kilovolt power supply. Super dangerous.
What could possibly go
It
wrong?
turns out it jams your
Jeez.
Wi-Fi. And then on the battery side,
All right.
we had like eight batteries for these things with like four chargers just constantly cycling in and out. And then we had backup robots. So we had three robots that we would run that were all set up to run the same demo that you could quickly switch over to and fail over to and use like when you're servicing one or swapping the battery, you could pull up another one. Another thing that would happen is there was a feature on the maze that was a tunnel with a bunch of J hooks along the side that carried cable. And then there was an obstacle, which was it was like a fog machine that was hooked in to look like a steam leak coming out of a hose that was going along that cable tray. But what would happen was the J hooks, the top of the robot chassis would get caught on the J hook and it would invert in a way where it was like a turtle on its back and it couldn't get up. And so we started keeping like brooms and sticks around to get them unstuck when that would happen. So yeah, plenty of things
Sometimes
that went
analog
wrong.
solutions are the best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we kind of got lucky that a lot of the people driving them were engineers, you know, and sort of were understanding about some of the shortcomings. But and we found a lot of these when we were testing, but some of them just came out live. And you know, I mean, if it had been like an investor demo, I think it would have gone differently. But
That's part of practice, right? And also understanding like the for each demo, what's the cost of failure, right? Because like in a lot of cases, the cost of failure is it can kill your entire startup. And so understanding that like if you're not ready to give a demo, don't give the demo, because no demo is better than a failed demo, and if a failed demo is going to kill your startup.
For sure.
And that's a cultural thing as much as anything, of like your whole org has to line up around what has to be true before we're willing to give a demo? And are all of those boxes checked? Not most of them, but are all of them?
Yeah.
And so that part's like, that's the kind of discipline that let when I was at Mayfield and we were launching that the Curry robot at CES back in 2017. Like, that approach is why we won Best of CES. We had the robot that worked no matter what, all
nice.
The time. And it was contingencies and backups and really sharp engineers that, and a lot of practice
on call. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like, this was, we only had one chance to do it.
Yeah.
And so it's like, we didn't skimp on stuff.
Yeah. Makes sense. If it's that critical to the company's success, you can't afford to.
Right. And so it's like that whole, just like you said, when we started the demo topic, right? That, like, I hope this goes well. It's like, no, you need to be so confident that you don't worry about it, that it's as easy as anything.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. I think it depends what you're demoing and what the expectation of the user is too.
Yep.
If you're putting
yep.
it on display at CES, you know, then yes.
Sure.
I completely right. agree.
But like that was a coordinated thing where that was also the first time it had ever been seen by anybody.
Yeah.
So like it was a lot of stakes, like all the chips on the table all at once.
It seems like that happens at CES a decent amount with different companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a big stage and it's a chance for, like, I mean, at the time we were a company of like 40 something people, right? So to win Best in Show awards and nominations from like Engadget and Wired and PC Magazine for a company of 40 at a show like that, there's very very few places where you have even the access to that kind of visibility, and then you have to pull it off.
Yeah,
it's a noisy place, right? Like it's very noisy, but part of winning in a situation like that is the prep.
How'd you get around the Bluetooth problem? Because like I don't even trust Bluetooth with anything critical anymore.
So Bluetooth was used for very limited parts of the demo. It was mostly over Wi-Fi.
Yeah, makes sense.
I've certainly seen Bluetooth failures, but
they're way too common for like a technology
I mean,
that mature.
It is a fragile system, right? It's just the best one that we have.
Yeah, agreed.
And
some Bluetooth radios are better than others for sure.
Right. And like we knew at the time the features that we wanted to show that were really going to differentiate us were more on bringing the robot to life and making the robot's personality shine through. And so that's what we focused on. But yeah, it is still a common failure point for a lot of people. And so understanding, like, if you have to plug something physically into the robot with a wire because Bluetooth failed, do you have a way to do that? Or is the access port like underneath 9 different things that you have to unscrew?
Nice. Okay. That's clever.
Right? Like those kind of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense to me. And, you know, does everybody know the drill to plug it in? I would assume is another part of it.
Right. Yeah. Like
what script do we have to load? Yeah. Where's the tools?
Yeah. Yep. Where's
have
your
you practiced
tools?
It? Yeah, exactly.
Is there a kit with each robot? Right. Like not one kit, but a kit with each robot.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree.
Yep.
Yeah. And something you get from experience and practice. What are you excited for coming up?
Let's see. I've got a few companies I'm talking to right now on different projects. They're all super interesting in different robotics areas. I guess kind of like you, I can't say too much about them other than like there's a lot of cool stuff happening in the nav and 3D spatial space right now.
Oh, cool.
The like intersection of spatial AI and physical AI and computer vision Like there's a lot of neat new stuff there.
Just figuring out what you're looking at from sensors,
exactly.
Basically. Okay,
like,
cool.
What am I looking at? Where am I?
Yeah.
Where should I go?
No,
next,
I agree.
Right?
That stuff is awesome.
And,
have you looked at Velo AI at all?
Which one?
Velo AI. They're
no.
A Pittsburgh company. Clark Hayes is the founder.
Okay. Don't know that one.
It's a bunch of self-driving engineers that are applying that technology to bicycles. So they're doing like being aware of like irregular driving behavior in cars around you and being able to be like safer on the road on a bicycle through sensors and tech and understanding what's going on.
I'll have to take a look at that.
Yeah. Happy to make an intro if you want one.
I mean, just want to see if I want to be a customer. Like
that's the kind of stuff
I worry about, right? Like I was out riding this morning and like I got front and rear dash cams running on my bike all the time. Just as a, you know, it's one thing I can do.
Yeah.
It's still, that doesn't make me safer. The lights make me safer, but the idea of having better data when you're riding is still something that has not been cracked.
Yeah. I mean, they're as far along as anyone I know. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll check them out.
Definitely let me know what you think.
Cool.
Well, I think we're at a good spot. Anything you want to plug on the way out?
I mean, the book's called Start Telling People. It's on Amazon, both print and Kindle, as well as on Audible. I did the narration of the book myself in a little studio in Palo Alto, and so that was a really interesting experience as well. If any of your listeners end up picking up a copy, reading or listening to it, I love the feedback, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, of like what resonates and what people think is really interesting.
What's the best way for people to reach out to you if they want to give you that feedback?
Easiest way is through you find me on LinkedIn super easily, or through the website, which is verysmallrobots.com. That's my own site. And so that's got links to the book and links to some previous work I've done. There's a contact form there, or just chris@verysmallrobots.com gets me as well.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it. It's been a blast.
Thanks for having me. This is super fun.
Yeah, I agree. We'll have to do it again sometime.
All right.
Thanks for joining us today. If you made it this far, chances are you'll like other episodes too. Collaborative with Spencer Krause is available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, and Radio Public. Subscribe today to get notified when the latest episodes release and support the channel. Collaborative with Spencer Krause is sponsored by SKA Custom Robots and Machines. If you're in the market for robotics contract engineering services, please consider hiring SKA Custom Robots and Machines. They sponsor this podcast and they solve some of the toughest engineering challenges in the world. SKA Custom Robots and Machines can be found at ska.solutions. Thanks again, and see you on the next one.